First of all, thank you very much for giving me the possibility to present my work here. So today, I will be talking about gluon scattering amplitudes of planar n equals 4 super Yanimils. Of course, in principle, one would like to study theories that are more realistic than n equals 4 super Yanimil, like, for instance, QCD. However, this theory, n equals 4, can still, or at least we hope, give some non-trivial information about more realistic theories, but is much more tractable. In particular, in the last years, there has been many tools that became available. In particular, today, I will use two of these tools. First, the so-called EDS-CFT duality that allow us to study the strong coupling regime of this gauge theory by studying a weakly coupled string sigma model. On the other hand, in the last few years, people have seen that a particular class of higher loop amplitudes, gluon amplitudes, the so-called maximal helicity violating amplitudes, satisfy some remarkable iterative structure. Roughly, you can express some loop amplitude in terms of lower loops amplitudes. This has led to a proposal for all loops endpoint amplitudes. So the aim of this talk is to give a prescription for computing gluon scattering amplitudes of planar n equals 4 super Yanimil by using the EDS-CFT duality. And please, during my talk, well, there are many things I don't understand, so I would enjoy very much discussing with you. So stop me at any time, asking me any questions, and I will try to do my best. The organization of the talk, I will review very briefly what are the gauge theory results and what are these proposals that I have mentioned. Then I will show one slide about the EDS-CFT duality. Then I will proceed and I will motivate the string theory setup, why we do the computation we are doing. And then we will see how to do the detailed computation for the 4-point amplitude at a strong coupling. And then I will end up with some conclusions and outlook. So the proposal, sorry about references, I am not very good at them, but the proposal I will describe was basically shown by Bernd, Dixon, and Smirnov, and then developed by some other people. So they have considered that. Oh, do you have some kind of point? Any, it's okay. Oh, I can. Anything in the chart? Well, it's not that important. I mean, it's. Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Sorry. Thank you.
It's not like straight in the projector.
So these people, they have considered the leading NC, NC is the number of colors, color order endpoint amplitudes at L loops. Of course, like a full amplitude is the sum of some permutations of these color ordered amplitudes, but it is easier to study these color order amplitudes that we denote by A and L. These amplitudes turn out to be infrared divergent, so they are infinity. So we must introduce some regulator. And a pretty popular regulator is the so-called dimensional regularization that consists in studying this theory not in four dimensions, but in 4 - 2 epsilon. Then the amplitudes will depend explicitly on this parameter epsilon. What people have observed is that if we scale out the three-level amplitude and define a new amplitude m, then up to a few loops, ml, the amplitude at L loops, can be written in terms of lower order amplitudes. For instance, such relation for 4-point amplitude at 2 loops, it is related to the 4-point amplitudes at 1 loop as follows. So it is roughly the square of the 1-loop amplitude plus some function times the 4-point amplitude computed in a dimension, shifted dimension, 4 minus 4 epsilon, plus some constant, plus something that vanishes as you take epsilon to 0. For us, the most interested, actually, motivated by this kind of observations, plus the study of the infrared behavior of these amplitudes, they have proposed a all loop result for MHB amplitudes. Actually, for us, it won't be that important that the amplitudes are MHB, but the proposal works just for MHB, maximal helicity violating gluon amplitudes. So the proposal looks as follows. So for instance, here alpha is the parameter that keep track of the loop expansion. So if you want to know what the proposal is for 27 loops, you should expand this and look for the coefficient of alpha to the 27. That is how it works. This lambda is the coupling constant in four dimensions. That is the guy that we keep fixed as we take epsilon to 0. Well, this f is some function that depends only on epsilon. And this c is some constant. A very particular feature, a very important feature of this proposal, is that this f and c don't depend on n, the quantity of gluons. So once you have computed and established this iterative relation for, let's say, four gluons, that makes a prediction for what the iterative relation for any number of gluons should be. This mu, for instance, is the infrared cutoff, is some infrared scale. We will be interested, we will perform explicit computations for the particular case n equals 4. In that case, the amplitude looks as follows. It contains a divergent piece here and a finite piece. The interesting property of this is that the divergent piece is controlled by two functions, f and g. F controls the leading infrared divergency and is the so-called the cusp anomalous dimension, and this function g controls the subleading, the 1 over epsilon piece of the infrared divergences. Notice that the finite piece depends on the kinematical variables. Here s and t are the usual Mandelstam variables of the four-point amplitude, and this function f is the same as the function appearing here. Well, they are related through this. So for future reference, notice that the finite piece this finite contains this important factor, some constant k times the log s over t square. So is there some questions at this point? Well, this was just a reminder of what the proposal for the n equals 4 amplitudes is. So as I have already mentioned, we will use the ADS-CFT duality in order to compute these amplitudes at the strong coupling. One way of seeing how this duality arises is by considering, this is just one slide. Of course, there may be many seminars about the ADS-CFT duality, but I want just to. It's just by considering a stack of these three brains, then there are two equivalent descriptions of this system. One description is in terms of some low energy theory that describes the degrees of freedom of the D brain. And another description is in terms of a string theory that lives on a curved background that is induced by the matter density of these brains. More precisely, what this duality says is that four-dimensional maximally supersymmetric Yanni-Mills or n equals 4 super Yanni-Mills is dual to tie to B string theory compactified on ADS-5 cross S-5. In particular, this duality provides us with a dictionary between the parameters of the two theories. So for instance, the Yanni-Mills coupling constant is related as follows to the string coupling constant, and the TOF coupling constant, that is Yanni-Mills squared times the number of colors, is related to the radius of ADS, that is equal to the radius of the sphere in string units. This is, well, just a very brief introduction, but some questions, comments. Okay. So, well, how we do use this duality in order to compute amplitudes. So, later on, we will use something more similar to what we have called dimensional regularization. That is what people do in the gauge theory. But in order, for the moment, let's use another regularization. And this other regularization is, well, let's start with the metric of ADS5 that is as follows. And then let's place a D-brain extended along these four dimensions and located at some large value of C infrared. Yes.
So here, what are you doing with the S5? Because, of course, if you just put a
this is
D-brain,
a
that'll break the...
Exactly. You put the it shouldn't matter. You put the brain at some point in the S5. It shouldn't matter in which point you are. Of course, you should, for what we will do, that is just to compute the leading part of the amplitude, it doesn't matter which point of the S5 you're choosing.
So you're using basically this point on the Coulomb branch.
Exactly. Indeed. Mm-hmm. So, we will
have a way to sort of remind me way of stabilizing the brain there so that it doesn't move around. How do you think about?
Oh, I see. Well, we will move it around, actually.
You want to be able to move it where you want it to be, not for it to move itself, so to speak.
But
typically you get fluctuations and so on. Again, it's related to this whole question of where are the brains and fluctuations.
I see. Well, but I mean, like in some sense, I think we want to put it by hand. In the sense, it's not that we are considering a system with the brain. It's just that we are considering it as a regulator, right? So, I mean, like it should be a parameter that you move as you wish, let's say.
So I'm asking what the prescription would be. If that takes you too far afield.
I am not completely sure I understand the question. I mean, like, you see, well, what we are doing now is, or maybe better to say, is we just suppose the scattering, some scattering of strings that end in some D-brain, right? But that is just like a trick for making the theory regular, right? For making the amplitude finite. But I don't know if in some physical meaning, in some physical sense, there is really a brain in the infrared, right?
I'm just worried about fluctuations in the position of the brain.
Yeah, I guess you should worry about that if you want to do subleading, right? I mean, we will have some classical solution.
Well, maybe another way to say it, I mean, the strings you're going to be interested in are ones that stretch out from infinity and end.
Mm.
No.
Exactly.
Because those are the same ones which are going to be...
Yeah, the concern is that the higher order corrections might be the same order of magnitude as your leading kind of vision, which would just correspond to that brain just flying around
them.
Well, I mean,
it's a conformal theory, and there's a moduli space of vacuum. You can separate this brain as much as you want to; it doesn't change the physics.
Well, you can separate it, but there's a zero mode for its position.
Yes. So, but he's going to talk about the other strings, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, like
the other strings meaning
the ones that are off diagonal, the W modes.
No, I mean the open strings that we scatter are strings that end on this D brain.
Yeah, they have both endpoints on this D brain.
Yeah.
I mean,
both
like.
Yep.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, like this is I must admit that this is the way in which we motivate the computation. At the end of the day, we don't do this.
But in the end of the day, whatever you do, think of it as just putting a cutoff on Z. And instead of putting in a physical brain, they're just cut off my computations at some value of Z, which is not the same as going to the Coulomb branch at one breaking of the SO6 symmetry that Steve was worried about.
Yeah.
Well, then there's the question of how you...
No, just, you know, whatever the answer I get from gravity side, I'll just cut off the integral at some given value of Z. That's another
Yeah, I don't know. Because,
I mean, one way we know to do something like this is set up the German Matt Strassler use.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty much the same.
Well,
the difference, well, they do consider...
I guess you could put a brain at the bottom of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the differences is that if we put, so what we are doing here is we place at the brain, the computation we want to do, at some C infrared, right? And then we have this kind of open strings, right? And then we are scattering these open strings. Our asymptotic states, what we say is that these open strings is what corresponds to asymptotic states of the gluons.
Taking SUN, the SUN theory, breaking it down to SUN cross U, SUN minus 1 cross U1, and then looking at U1 charged.
Yeah, actually, it's a point that we don't, probably yes, but that is something we don't fully understand yet. I mean, what is the relation between, for instance, because these gluons, you put some, what we do for the moment, I mean, here we directly, we start with the EDS5 metric. So the stack of M-brains are already dissolved, right? So there, in that background, we put some D-brain, that is this infrared D-brain, and there we consider these open strings. A question, sorry, related to what you are telling is, for instance, why the Champaton factor of these brains should have something to do with the Champaton factor of the original D-brains, right?
It looks to me like you can always think of this as SUN cross U1 theory that you
probably yes.
Or SUN cross several U1s, right? I mean, you probably need several.
Yeah, exactly.
In the limit in which you push this brain all the way to infrared, so you remove the regulator, it becomes part of the big SUN.
Yeah.
So in some sense.
Yeah.
But you do something, but before doing that, you go to 3 plus epsilon dimensions, right?
That we will do later on. Yeah. For the moment, we can think. That's why I say that is not what we do exactly. I mean, like this, we motivate the computation, but then we take DC infrared to infinity. The brain is not there anymore. The amplitudes will be divergent. And then we introduce the same as the gauge theory dimensional regularization. That is what we end up by doing. But like this, we can motivate why we do the computation as we do it. But at the end of the day, we don't put a D-brain. Actually, and probably what you say is true, but we haven't checked explicitly. Actually, so as we are discussing, what we do is we place a deep brain in the infrared. Usually, indeed, you should consider several U1s, but actually, if you are interested only in this color ordered amplitude. At the strong coupling, then you can do it just with one brain. That will be equivalent. Then the asymptotic states are open strings that end on this D brain, and we consider a scattering of these open strings. So notice that the proper momentum of these strings will be something like K C infrared over R, is very large. Here we are interested in the regime in which this k, that is like the momentum in the field theory units, is kept fixed as C infrared is very large. So what we actually are interested in is the regime of a scattering of open strings with fixed angle and very high momentum. Fortunately for us, this regime was already considered in flat space by Gross and Mende. And the key feature of this computation is that the amplitude is dominated by a saddle point of the classical action. For our particular case, we will be interested in considering a classical string on EDS. So what we will need to consider is a worksheet with the topology of a disk. I mean, when you take this, this will have the topology of a disk, right? With vertex operator insertions corresponding to the external states, right? So the boundary conditions should be such that near each vertex operator, the momentum of the external state will fix the form of the solution, and the boundary of the worksheet has to end on the deep brain. So C has to be equal to C infrared. To simplify the computation, we found convenient to go to some kind of t-dual variables. And I say some kind of because these x's are not compact. So if we have a metric as follows, we define the t-dual variables in the usual way, in according to Bastian rules. So for instance, the boundary conditions will translate in such a way that if x mu carries momentum k mu, then these dual coordinates y mu will have some winding delta y mu that will be 2 pi k mu. I will be more precise by what I mean by this winding in the next slide. After a change of coordinates, r equals r squared over c, we end up again with the ADS5 metric. So we will have exactly the same metric as we had before, but in terms of this y and r coordinates.
For anything more than getting the classical string solution?
That's a very good question. I think that this picture will be still valid if you compute the first order corrections, but probably you can go on if you are interested in higher corrections.
But all you actually need to do is find the classical solution?
Yeah, we do find the classical solution in the original variables. You could come back.
Using this technique?
Yes, yes. But once you have found the classical solution in these variables, you can come back and you have it in the original variables. So our worksheet will be a worksheet whose boundary is located at r squared over c infrared. And will be a particular line that is constructed as follows. So for each particle with momentum k mu, draw a segment joining two points separated by 2 pi k mu. So this would be the segments. So for instance, what I have drawn here corresponds to a 6-point amplitudes. So each external state here, each vertex insertion, corresponds to some of these segments. Then next, concatenate the segments according to the ordering of insertions in the disks that will correspond to some color insertion. Then for instance, momentum conservation will imply that this diagram will be closed. Furthermore, as we are considering gluons, massless states, this k mu will be Lie-like vectors. So for instance, this is time, and these two y1 and y2 are space-like coordinates. As C infrared, as we take away the infrared cutoff, as we take C infrared to infinity, the boundary of this worksheet moves to r equals 0. And actually, the computation we have to do is exactly the same computation as you would do if you want to compute the expectation value of this Wilson loop, given by this sequence of Lie-like segments.
So in the original coordinates, this boundary of this worksheet would have been in the infrared. But now in the new coordinates, it's sort of at the UV.
Well, yeah, this is a very good question. Actually, they are still at the boundary. To see, well, like in the paper, we can discuss it later, but if you go to embedding coordinates, you can see better where they are. I mean, the boundary conditions are still in the... in the boundary of ADS.
But didn't you start with boundary conditions away, I mean, in the infrared, in the opposite?
Actually, well, it's not so clear in the C coordinates. It looks, I mean, the point is that when you go to global coordinates, C equals infinity. I mean, the boundary usually is said that is C equals 0, right? That the boundary is there. But actually, when you write the solution in global coordinates, you can see that it touches the boundary.
Yeah, every C equals constant surface has an infinite Minkowski space. And then you don't have to infinity in that Minkowski space. Reaches part of the boundary.
Exactly. And it's the case for this solution as well, indeed.
Mm-hmm. But in your next slide, you have this
you want to find a world shape where the boundary is this curve, but this is a finite curve now on your...
Yeah.
So it's not going off to infinity.
Well, in these coordinates R, then you can come back to the in these coordinates Y and R. Then you can go back to the original coordinates, and then indeed you are fixing boundary conditions on the boundary. That is okay, it's what ADS CFT tells you to do. Okay.
But how is this reconciled with the motivation that you were doing some infrared regulation?
Well, I mean, you can see these kind of coordinates just as a trick to, I mean, like, for instance, one of the things when you go from R to C, then you can see that the solution for this y coordinates is real instead of imaginary. And it looks like it's much easier to... I mean, once you have found the solution, you can go back to the original coordinates and check there whether the solution goes to the boundary or doesn't.
Right, but the boundary or away from the boundary is a coordinate independent statement.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
so I'm confused about whether you're imposing boundary conditions.
At the boundary. No, at the boundary, but it's easier to see that if you write the things in global coordinates, in embedding coordinates. That is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So, exactly. So, this is, so our prescription, is that okay? Or, well, we can mm-hmm. So our prescription is the following. What we are saying is that the leading exponential behavior of the endpoint scattering amplitudes is given through this relation by the area of a minimal surface that ends on a sequence of Lie-Lie segments on the boundary. And the dynamical information of the amplitude, that is the momenta of the gluons we are scattering, are given through these segments, right? So through the boundary conditions that we impose for that area. Notice that in general, so this is the relation. So in general, there will be prefactors. These prefactors, things entering here, will be subleading in 1 over square root of lambda, and we don't compute them. For instance, one of the things is that our computation will be blind to the helicity of the gluons. Right. So some other question? Yeah, that actually, like, no, I mean, in the sense, this is some kind of infinite, depends on the infrared cutoff that you choose, right? So you should see, I mean, the value of this kind of amplitudes is as some intermediate step when you are computing some infrared safe quantity. Like Gauss invariant quantities, physical quantities, should be infrared safe. This is not. But I mean, like, well, they are as Gauss invariants or as not Gauss invariants as these amplitudes, right? As the amplitudes of n equals 4.
Right, so what confuses me is how can you get something that's not Gauss invariant? Maybe I'm misunderstanding what.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, actually, what we next. Well, I will explain how we introduce what the equivalent of this dimensional regularization in the supergravity will be. That is what allows to compare these two quantities. I mean, these quantities that are infinity on both sides, but they are infinity in a way that you can control it. Yeah, this F actually is the only Gauss invariant quantity that enters in this, because it's the CASP anomalous dimensions. So actually, it's the anomalous dimension of some operator. But this piece G is not Gauss invariant. For instance, you can see that if you shift mu by 2 mu, then this G gets shifted by something proportional to F, right?
Right, but this Wilson loop that you're going to evaluate, that's a Gauss invariant by construction you obtain it from ADS.
Yeah, but it's infinity, right? So you have to regulate it. So as I already mentioned, we will explicitly show how to compute a four, I mean how to perform this program for the 4-point amplitude. We will consider two particles, 1 and 3, going into 2 and 4, and we introduce the usual Mandelstam variables as follows. Then, in that case, the diagram will be something like this. Again, this is time, and this is y1 and y2. And so we will have these are the momentum of the gluons. So all what we need to do is we need to find the minimal surface ending on such sequence of light-like segments. As a warm-up, we could try to find the solution near one of these cusps, right? So we are focusing only in one of these corners. So in such case, the surface will look as follows. Here is time, and here is r, the r coordinate. So this surface can be embedded in EDS3. So we use Poincaré coordinates, y0, y1, and r. One way to make explicit the symmetries of the problem is by going to these coordinates, tau and sigma, and then we can plug the following ansatz for the r coordinate, and we will get the following Nambu-Goto action. This problem was considered by Kruchensky, and one can check explicitly that W equals to some constant, that turns out to be square root of 2, is a solution of the equations of motion. For instance, that implies that R is a square root of 2 y0 square minus y1 square. And notice that in the edges, here and here, you have that y1 is equal to plus minus y0, and indeed R is 0 there. So that are the boundary conditions. So it's this very simple. It's like good idea to consider this solution in embedding coordinates. So in these coordinates, we will see EDS5 as a surface embedded in R2,4. This is the 2 and 4, right? And the relation between embedding coordinates and Poincaré coordinates is as follows. So the surface of the cusp in these embedding coordinates is simply this. So you have 6 coordinates with one condition from here, 2, 3, 4. So you have a two-dimensional surface that is the surface of the cusp. Well, coming back to our original problem, to the 4 segments. Actually, a nice idea to write the Nambu-Goto action is to use Poincaré coordinates, r, y0, 1, y1, and 2, and parameterize the surface by its projection to the y1, y2 plane. So remember the cube that we have. So we will use this to parameterize our surface. Notice, by the way, that if S is equal to T, then this is a perfect cube, and the projection is just a square. It's just a square. So in general, we will have the Nambu-Goto action will be an action for two fields, R and Y0. And for instance, if S is equal to T, the two fields will live on a square that is parameterized by Y1 and Y2. So the Nambu-Goto action is just as follows. And by scaling variance, we can put the edge of the square to plus minus 1. And then the boundary conditions for the field will be as follows. R has to vanish when you go to the square, and the time y0 coordinate has to go up and down, as you can see here. So as you move in the edges of the square, the time has to go up and down, up and down. So you can see that these boundary conditions are exactly what I have written here, if you put the edges of the square in plus minus 1. Actually, we know the solution near the cusp, right? So by doing like boost, etc., you can know what the solution near any of the 4 cusps is, so you can make some guess. We did this guess. right? The first case we have tried, that first of all can be easily seen to satisfy all the boundary conditions. So for instance, if any of these two guys is equal to 1, R vanishes, and y0 goes up and down. And it turned out that to be a solution of the equations of motion. So that is exactly the solution for the square that we were looking for. Now, well, one question one can wonder, this is a solution for the equations in the, for the Nambu-Goto action. So in the conformal gauge, you can also write a solution. In that case, you have to compute the induced metric on the worksheet, that is this, where we have done this change of coordinates. And then in terms of these u coordinates, remember y1 and y2 are the tangent hyperbolic, the solution is as follows, y1, y2, r, and y0. So this is a very simple classical solution, and it can be seen to be a solution of the action in the conformal gauge, of the equations of motion coming from the conformal gauge. One can wonder what is the solution in the embedding coordinates that I have previously shown, and these are that. And the surface is actually very simple. It's simply given by this quadratic relation, and this y3 and y4 equals 0. Now, okay, we have the solution for the square, but remember that one piece of the amplitude that was very interesting is this log of s over t. Right? So if s is equal to t, and we use the fact that log of 1 is 0, we would miss this piece. So if we want to get this kinematical dependence of the amplitude, we have to consider the case s different from t. So for this case, the square, what before was a square, will be deformed to a rhombus. And one can actually very easily see that the distance between two opposite cusps is square root of t and square root of s. So, well, actually we were struggling for a couple of weeks on how to get the solution for the rhombus starting from the solution of the square. But actually it's very simple. You start with the surface in embedding coordinates, right? Remember this solution, and then you simply do a boost in the 0-4 direction. This boost will change the distance between these points, so you can generate the rhombus. After this boost, the solution looks as follows, and you can come back and write the solution in Poincaré coordinates. So here is the solution. This parameter B is a parameter that depends on this, the velocity of the boost. And this A, we have reintroduced the scale that before we put to 1. So we put the square in minus A and A. So now the solution, we have a solution that will have the boundary conditions of this rhombus that depends on these two parameters, A and B. And these two parameters will encode the dynamical information of the four-point scattering amplitude. The precise relation, the Mandelstam variables S and T, are given as follows. So for instance, S over T will be some function of B. And, well, so like that. So is there some questions or comments? Okay. So okay, now we have the solution. We can plug into the action and compute the area. Except for a small problem, that is that the area diverges. That is not surprising because we have taken the infrared cutoff, right? So, well, what people does in the gauge theory is they use what is called dimensional reduction scheme. That is, they consider a theory in 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions, but still with 16 supercharges. That is more precisely the dimensional reduction of 10 dimensionals n equals 1. But if this v is integer, that is actually the low energy theory living on a DP brain, where p is d minus 1. So for that, we know what the gravity dual is. We will have this metric, right? This is the metric in the string frame, and this is lambda, and, well, we have this constant CD. Notice that if you put epsilon equals 0, we go back to the EDS case, that EDS 5 that we were considering before. We will indeed, as well, we were discussing, forget about this sphere. We put everything like in a point. Now when we go to the t-dual coordinates, we will acquire first of all this factor into the metric that before was a square root of lambda, now will be something a little bit more complicated, but it's just a factor, doesn't make any much difference. And this 1 over r to the epsilon relative to what we have before. Again, when we compute the Nambu-Goto action or the action in the conformal gauge, we will have the same Lagrangian as before, but with this factor 1 over r to the epsilon. So there is one good thing, is that the presence of this epsilon will make all the integrals that we were computing convergent, right? But there will be something bad, and is that the equations of motion will now depend on epsilon. We have solved the equations of motion for the case epsilon equals 0. But, And actually, we couldn't find the general solution for the square. For the cusp, actually, we were very lucky, because if you propose, remember that the solution for the cusp was this W equals to some constant, you can put the same ansatz, and it's exactly a solution of the equation of motion, but now this constant will change. And in the solution for the cusp will be R equals square root of 2 plus epsilon. When you plug this into the action, you will get something convergent, and it will be something like 4 over epsilon square times some function that won't be much important for us. This is some ultraviolet cutoff in this coordinate y plus and y minus. And this A epsilon goes to some constant as epsilon goes to 0. The important thing to notice is that every time we have a cusp, from this cusp region, we will get a contribution of to the double pole, 1 over epsilon square, right? And that is a general feature, actually. So, as I already mentioned, we don't know. We couldn't compute the general solution for arbitrary epsilon. However, in general, if you find the solution, if you are very powerful and you have found the solution, yeah, it's kind of clear that you will be able to tailor expand the solution, right? But it turns out that we are not interested in the whole area. I mean, when you compute the area of the amplitude of our classical solution, the area will start with some term that goes with 1 over epsilon square plus something 1 over epsilon plus something finite plus something of order epsilon, etc. It turns out that we are interested about this finite piece, up to finite piece. Why? Well, first, because it's the only thing we can compute with what we know. And second, because in the gauge theory, they claim that you cannot get too far from four dimensions, that they see iterative relations only for this piece of the amplitudes. So even if we compute, we wouldn't know with what to compare this kind of piece. So in computing the amplitude, we will be interested only in this in this order. And it turns out that if you are interested only in that piece, you need to know this R1 only near the cusps. But we actually do know R1 near the cusp, because we know the full solution for the cusp, right? So the key observation is that we can correct the fields by multiplying by this constant in such a way that we take into account the contribution coming from the cusps, right? From these four cusps. And then we can plug this solution into the action with the epsilon dependence, and that will give us an answer accurate enough for what we want to compute.
In picture, so you have this world sheet, which is the saddle point, which is kind of down in the infrared, and it goes out asymptotically to these boundary points where you're injecting your strings that are coming in, and the cusps are sort of off where you're sending in the strings?
Yeah, it's like two, actually. I mean, the strings, you should see more like this edge, actually. Also, in the gauge theory, it happens something very similar. I mean, in the gauge theory, when you compute this amplitude,
you draw a picture or a sketch of the world.
Oh, in the original coordinates, you mean? Yeah, it's not very. We tried to, so we put a picture in the paper, and it wasn't that simple. But like, in this T-dual coordinates, I think it's pretty easy, right?
But in the original coordinates, again, the cusps are sort of off where the strings are being created and coming in.
Yeah, I think that a picture. Well, if you think about this, the brain, right? Like the strings are like this. Here they are pretty near the brain. Then as they reach the interaction point, they start to separate from the D-brain. They interact to some kind of this distance, and then they go. We must.
And the main, so the main contribution comes from the point, so.
Yeah, but the main contribution, I think you should see like from this.
Oh, from that, it's between the two.
Yeah, it's between the two. And in the gauge theory, it happens something pretty similar, because when you compute, well, people, does these four gluons is what they call the hard gluons. And actually, when you compute Feynman diagrams, you can see that this 1 over epsilon squared, the leading, comes from like exchange of gluons between two consecutive hard gluons. It's, well, I am not an expert in gauge theory, but it's what they call soft gluons. So it can. So this you can see as the cusp, exactly. So and it corresponds to this. In this diagram, it's not one of these, but it's like the two. Is that? Mm-hmm. Okay. So okay. Now we have this solution. We plug into the action, right? With epsilon dependence. So okay, we plug everything. We got something like this. It's not that simple. Well, it's some cosine hyperbolic of U1, U2 to the epsilon. This Y1 and Y2 were like not very nice expressions. They are even uglier than this. But after some tricks, you can actually compute this integral of U, and you obtain this. Here there are this parameter B epsilon that is a function of A. That A is the, well, is the A, this A here. Depends on S and T. There are other also this. CD and lambda D, and also the parameter B here. So A and B, once we introduce what the Mandelstam variables were in terms of A and B, will give the dependence of this amplitude in the Mandelstam variables. And this will have some complicated dependence on epsilon. But anyway, it's straightforward to put everything together and expand in epsilon. And this is our final answer. So that is. So for instance, to notice, well, first of all, the amplitude, we get some divergent part plus some constant piece. The divergent piece has a leading, some leading divergent part that goes with 1 over epsilon squared times this square root of lambda and mu, etc., and this subleading piece. Then the finite piece has two parts, one that is proportional to log of s over t squared. That came because of B. Remember that this parameter B was some complicated function of S over T, and this is some constant. Actually, well, we did compute this constant, but we cannot make a prediction. Remember that when you compute the four-point amplitude, there are two constants that enter into the game. One is this C, and another is this F2. So we predict what a linear combination of these two would be. But in order to compute the two of them at a strong coupling, we should do a computation for other for the six gluons, etc. So that is why I am not writing what we got for C. But we got something. Then notice that, and this should be compared with the string theory answer, with the gauge theory answer. So the things we note, yeah, is there any questions or comments?
Factor of I, exponential I S divergent, is the gauge theory thing imaginary as well?
The
your top line.
Mm-hmm, I see.
The amplitude is e to the I times the S divergent.
Mm-hmm.
Rest.
You know what case?
In the gauge theory, bottom line, is that function f minus 2 a real function?
Maybe I think here I said no. I think this is real. Here I should put an I.
An I
yeah. Okay. Now this is real.
Yeah.
Good question, sir. Thank you. Sorry. Yeah, this should be I. Yes, that is this indeed. Mm-hmm. If we inspect things, we can notice is first that the general structure is in perfect agreement with the field theory expectations, in particular with this conjecture of Bern, Dixon, and Smirnov. Second, that from this computation, we can extract the strong coupling value for the cusp anomalous dimension, that is this function f here, that will be this, that of course agrees with the very well-known result. These people, like Gapser, Klebanov, and Polyakov, they have computed that at the strong coupling. Then, if we make a comparison with the gauge theory, we can extract the strong coupling value for this function g that characterizes the subleading infrared divergences, the coefficient of the 1 over epsilon. And the thing that we are predicting is that at the strong coupling, this g will be square root of lambda over 4 pi to 1 minus log 2. Then, last, is we notice that the detailed dependence on the kinematics of the finite piece, I mean this piece here, the guy proportional to log s over 2, exactly agrees with what we expect. Remember that the strong coupling limit of f is exactly square root of lambda over pi. So this will get exactly what we expected. So some questions before I go to the conclusions? Okay. So, what have we done? Even if there are many things we don't understand or we would like to make more precise, we have given a prescription for computing planar gluon scattering amplitudes of n equal 4 super Yanimil at a strong coupling by using the ADS-CST duality. Then we have done a detailed computation for n equals 4, but the prescription is valid for any number of gluons. In particular, notice that if you are doing in the gauge theory a computation, to increase the number of gluons is really a problem, right? But I don't think it's much of a problem here.
So there are no iterative guesses for more than 4 gluons, these multi-loop relations?
Their guess is for all n and all. Yeah. This here and is, yeah. But actually, I will talk now. But actually, most of the computations they have done is for 4 gluons. But 4 gluons, first of all, supersymmetry is very restrictive. Then all the amplitudes are MHB for 4 gluons. So it's a very particular case. But they do have, so our results agree with the conjecture of Bern, Dixon, and Smirnov. And indeed, by comparing, we can extract the strong coupling behavior of this function g. And we hope that this is at least a small step towards understanding these kind of iterative structures that they were discovering from the point of view of string theory. And hopefully, we can do some other tests of the ADS-CFT duality. things that we would like to do or that need to be done. Well, there are many. First of them, I would say that it would be nice to try to make explicit computations for n bigger than 4. First of all, as we were just discussing, this will test the conjecture of the iterative extractor for n bigger, for arbitrary n. That actually most of the gauge theory computations have been done for, I think, 4 or 5 gluons, but there are not many tests for higher amplitudes. It would allow to compute the constant p's we were discussing if you have at least 2 different computations for n equals 4 and n equals 6, let's say, then you can compute these constants. Maybe it's a good idea to study some particular limits. For instance, 6 gluons, where 2 of the gluons are almost collinear, or the momentum are pretty small. That showed it to be very fruitful in the gauge theory point of view. So maybe it's also here. Notice that we haven't assumed or used at all the machinery, all this machinery of integrability. So maybe, I don't know, a smart way to proceed is by using the fact that the theory are integrable, etc. We haven't compute corrections in 1 over square root of lambda. This would give information about the helicity of the particles. Then something that Gross and Mende did was to compute higher genus amplitudes. They could show that, the fact that the amplitude is dominated by a saddle point is just not a question of the genus 0, but it extends to higher genus as well. Maybe here we can do the same. That is to be compared with 1 over n corrections in the gauge theory. Then a question is, can we repeat the computation for other backgrounds? I don't know. But it will be interesting for things less supersymmetric or like putting a black hole there. And then if we would be able to solve for epsilon, like not very near close to 0, but for arbitrary epsilon, maybe we can understand something about arbitrary dimensions. Thank you very much.
So at least in